Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. As always, feel free to reach out, Jeff, at beekeepingfornewbies.com. Okay, well, this is going to be a continuation of the Bee Buzz. So this is going to be Bee Buzz episode 19. There was way, way, way too much content for a single episode. I was really excited about it because I had so many questions that had just piled up, and I'm like, man, this is going to be great. And then I'm looking and I'm like, oh crap, we have so many more. So we're going to jump right back in. No special introductions or chitter chatter or whatever else. We're going to get back to business and get to work here. Okay. Can you do a quick review of the queen cell types? So typically you're going to have three types of queen cells. You have swarm cells, emergency cells, and supersedure cells. So I'll go through and kind of hit them all individually. A swarm cell is something that you're going to see typically in the spring, or really it can happen anytime when the bees are crowded. There is a common misconception that I have this new colony. I can't believe they're swarming. This doesn't make any sense. Why would a brand new colony swarm? I literally had that question the other day. It's a valid question, right? I just got this colony. How can they be swarming? Well, I can take a mini mating nuke. And these little mating nukes, I mean, they have like frames on them that are about, I don't know, 3 or 4 inches wide by 3 inches high. You get a group of, you know, young workers in there. They will draw that comb up in a couple of days. The queen will come back from her mating flight. She'll lay the whole thing up. Like as soon as she starts laying, within like 2 days, the whole thing is completely laid up. And what are they going to do next? Swarm cell, right? So the swarm cell really comes down to either space, whether it's real or perceived. And I talk about this a lot, about there's, you know, you space and there's bee space. The bees don't always see all the space that you do as being viable. And that's where you have to do some of those tricks we've talked about many times to make sure that they know, no, this really is for you. You need to use this. So if they feel crowded, if they feel like they're out of space, this is what triggers that thing within the hive, within the colony to say, all right, we need to make a queen cell. We need to plan to swarm. Swarm cells are typically found in the lower third of a frame. Now, there are some exceptions to this. Sometimes, you know, we try to break things down sometimes to be the way that we've organized them. Well, I have a box, and this box is my brood box. And above this box, since I'm doing a single brood chamber, above this box is honey. And above this box is more honey. So you have now created the brood chamber and honey configuration that you like. But the bees have a way of doing things that they like. Typically, if you just leave them to do whatever they want to do, the majority of the bottom, whatever it is, medium, deep, shallow, whatever it is, the majority of what's on the bottom is going to be brood. That may, depending on the size of it, go up into maybe occupy a third to a half of the next section above that. And then you'll have honey on the sides. And above that, it's usually all going to be honey, but it can sometimes even be brood up in there, depending on how things are organized and how she's moving and all of that. When I say that a swarm cell is typically on the bottom third of a frame, I mean that when we look at the frame as being the brood chamber. And what I'm saying is, let's say, for example, you had two deeps on, and the queen had been working in the bottom deep worked her way up to the deep above that, and she's laying in that one. And then for whatever reason, the workers made a queen cell. Instead of putting it at the bottom of the upper deep, they might put it at the top of the bottom deep. Because in their mind, it's still down like in that lower one-third of the entire brood chamber, viewing both deeps as one single big brood chamber. So just because a swarm cell or emergency cell or supersedure cell, just because one of these cells is not where you expect it to be, doesn't mean that it's not what you think it is. I know that might sound a little bit goofy and weird, but hopefully that makes sense. Just envision two deep hive bodies stacked on top of each other. And instead of viewing, let's say, frame 5 on each of them as like two separate brood chambers, think of it as one big brood chamber. So you may have a queen cell that's at the very top or even the middle of the bottom frame, the frame that's on the bottom in that configuration, still a swarm cell. The next type of cell would be an emergency cell. This can be kind of located anywhere, wherever the queen happened to be most recently, where the colony can find a young larva. I'm talking about like hatches from egg to larva. They give it royal jelly from that point. The younger, the better for new queens. It can be anywhere on the entire frame. Wherever she laid the most recent eggs, that's where I would be looking. Emergency cells are created in a couple of different ways. One of them is we've decided that we're going to do like a walk-away split, for example. We take everything out, divide it up in two. There's a queen in one place. The other place does not have a queen, and they're going to have to make one. When they have to make one from a young larva, that is an emergency cell. The other way that it could be is, let's say you're doing an inspection and you don't see that she was on the adjacent frame. You pulled your frame out. You're looking at it. She runs around the corner. You set the frame down, and it just happens to crush the queen. This is one of those things where you always hear about it. It happens. You know, I think a lot of times if it happens, you don't even know you did it. You just come back a couple weeks later and you're queenless and you're like, what happened? What's going on? I don't know where she went. I can't find her. There's no eggs. There's no larva. And I see this random cell here. What is that all about? Again, it's going to happen. Don't beat yourself up. A lot of people get really, really upset. Oh, I killed my queen. Like, it's part of the routine. It happens. One thing I've suggested several times is if you're doing an inspection and you come across the frame and you're like, oh, cool, there's the queen. See if you can go ahead and get her into a queen cage. And, you know, if it's really hot out, just move her to a shaded area or whatever. But if it's not too terribly hot, you can just set her on top of the frames that you've already inspected, or just set her maybe near the entrance, or just put her somewhere where she's, you know, out of the way. Do your full inspection. And then once all the frames are back into the hive, then you go ahead and release her and she'll just, boom, she'll scoot right back down into the, you know, in between the frames, and she's right back to work. So those are emergency cells. Now, the last type of cell for queen cells would be a supersedure cell. These are typically in the middle. And, you know, most of the time when you see a queen cell, a swarm cell, and it's really healthy, it looks like a big, long peanut. A lot of times when they have to make a hasty queen cell, and I see this with like the supersedure cells look like this a lot, they end up not looking as big because the majority of them are kind of inside the comb versus the swarm cells that tend to hang off the edges and stuff. But if you see one that's kind of right in the middle, again, keeping in mind what I said earlier about the location of them being potentially variable depending on the size of your brood chamber. But when you see them in the middle like that, that's, you know, quite often an indicator of a supersedure. For your treatment as a beekeeper, you know, you have two basic different categories. You have swarm cell and swarm cell management, and then emergency cell and supersedure cell. So swarm cell means big population, half the bees are getting ready to leave. I got to figure it out. I got to be aggressive. I got to track down all these queen cells, get rid of all the extra ones, make sure I have a viable queen, and all that stuff's going on. You're trying to save the integrity of the entire colony and keep them together. With the other two, there's nothing to worry about. You just want the queen to be born. You want her to go have a successful mating flight, and you want her to get back to work. No action is required on your part other than to do a couple things. If you see those cells pop up and you're not aware of any problems you have, immediately try to find your queen. If you cannot find your queen, then the next thing is to go and look for those eggs and that young larva. If you said, well, I did an inspection 10 days ago, and you pull a frame out and you see any eggs or larva at all. I mean, pretty much really anything that's uncapped. Well, you know, she was at least there within the last week after you did your inspection. So if you see eggs and larvae, she was there within, you know, eggs, she was there in the last 24 hours laying eggs, right? 24, 48 hours. So do the best to find that. If you go through the frames and you're really, really looking and you're not able to find anything, maybe you have a friend take a look, nobody's able to find anything, you just let the queen cells go. You know, go ahead and let them emerge and do their mating flights and do their thing and, you know, check again every week to 10 days and just see what happens. So hopefully that helps explain all the different types of cells and how they work. So the next question I have here is Varroa treatments with or without honey supers and how you manage that during a flow. So I'll tell you exactly how I do it. It's typically like a late February kind of thing. This is all a bit newer for me anyway. I have the oxalic acid vaporizer. So about like that late February timeframe when it's starting to ramp up, there's starting to be some activity around the hives. I hit them right away at like late February, early March. And then I'll go ahead and hit, like, let's say, for example, I do February 21st. I'll do a treatment on February 21st. I'll do a treatment on February 28th. And I'll do another one on like March 6th. That's the end of my spring treatment. Then typically when I get into the inspections in, you know, mid to late March, whenever I get some nice weather, I go ahead and I do my mite counts. I try to get it off of drones if I can. If I have excess drone brood, I'll just cut some out and just kind of do a little dissecting and playing around myself just for fun. But I try to sample as many drones as I can. But, you know, obviously, you know, you're going to get some workers too. Whatever you got, use what you got. But do try to get bees that are near brood. You want nurse bees. You want the bees that have recently emerged and have recently joined the colony so that you're getting more of the most accurate count. So I go ahead and pull my mite count then. If there's an issue, I'll go ahead and retreat. Usually those first three that I did are enough. Honey supers are going on depending on the colony and what's going on with them. Let's just say like 1 April. So honey supers hit through April. I don't really even think about it again until probably about June. Because for me, you get to around the June timeframe and you have the dearth. When the dearth gets here, that's when I like to do some more sampling. I want to get like, let's say like mid-June, like basically from the first week of June through like the end of June, anywhere in there, start sampling, getting your counts, seeing where you are. And then if you don't need to treat, bonus, right? I mean, if your spring treatments were enough that you did it the late winter, early spring, if that was enough for you and it worked, cool. If not, then, you know, plan to treat again. So let's just say, for example, I pull the honey on June 1st, June 5th, 10th, whatever it is. Pull my honey supers off. Get my mite counts in the next couple of weeks, treat as needed, and then I will probably check again in like late July. I want to do it before we get into August because that's usually anywhere from the first to like the third week of August is when that fall flow kicks in. So late July, I want to pull my mite numbers again because the alcohol wash is cheap. It doesn't take, you know, it's like 100 bees. It doesn't cost a lot of money. It's really pretty effective if you do it right. So that would be the check that I do in the like late July timeframe. And then I typically will just go ahead and treat in like late October, maybe as early November, somewhere in that timeframe, when I know that there's no new brood. It's just the bees. I'll go ahead and hit a treatment then. So it's really just, it's so much easier with the oxalic acid, with the vapor. You can just treat as needed, and it's a lot more cost effective. It was a heavy investment buying the vaporizer, but I can just treat whenever. And it makes it so much, like there's all those things that you kind of go through in life where you're like, yeah, I like doing that, but it's just such a headache to get all the logistical stuff done. And, you know, it becomes a pain in the butt. That's kind of how this is. Treating for Varroa can be really expensive when you're buying all your Apovar strips and all your different packets of this and packets of that. That stuff gets really expensive. And you start doing it for 8, 10, 20 colonies, it's an investment. You know, being able to vaporize them at probably like 30 cents a treatment, I do that all day long. But the real answer to the question is I never, even though I know you can vaporize with honey supers on, I don't do it. I just don't really have a need to do it. So the next question that I have is for during a dearth, when and how do you break down your hive? Like, when do you do it? You know, how would you do it? And the question is getting at, like, let's say, for example, we had 2 deeps and a honey super on top of that. And there's a dearth, so there's no new stuff coming in. well, should we reduce the size? Like, should we take some frames out and consolidate a little bit? What I would say is leave everything pretty much as it is. Now, there are some potential exceptions there, but let's just say that that your colony is as I described it, or that your hive is built out the way I described it. Maybe that honey super only has two drawn frames. Well, I would be willing to bet that either you would like to have that honey, or the bees might need that honey later. I think then it kind of comes down to how do you want to handle that part of it. If, for example, let's say that the deep below it, the middle hive body, let's say there's two frames of honey on each side, and you kind of have mostly like unused brood frames in the middle, let's say, maybe a little bit of nectar on them here and there and some bee bread. And the bottom is, you know, one or two frames of honey on the outside, and it's all just empty. Well, it might even be packed out. I've had that too, like where you have the whole thing just completely packed with honey. There's no brood in there anymore because they're done rearing brood, but they've got tons of resources. You're going to need to know how much your bees are going to need. You're going to need to kind of keep notes and ask people, talk to your mentor, talk to people in the bee club to figure out exactly how much you're going to need to have set aside for them. But an issue that comes up in the summertime is the heat. You know, it gets so daggone hot sometimes in the summer, even when you're up north. I mean, I've been in Alaska before and it's stinking hot sometimes, and up in Montana hot. You know, it doesn't matter where you are, you're still going to get hot. Having good ventilation is not a bad thing. If there's not a flow, you don't have to worry about them building a whole bunch of random comb. So leaving that super, that medium super up there that only has two frames drawn out with honey on it, that's okay. Now, where it becomes an issue is if the population is really, really low and there aren't really enough bees to even fill everything, then you might have to make some decisions because, well, the first thing is why is the population so low? But sometimes they do have, you know, it's like a roller coaster, right? You'll have ramp ups and drawbacks and ramp up and drawback. And that's just the cycle depending on the nectar flow and all of that. But having that extra space up there, if it's not being monitored and protected and cared for and all that, it could become a place where a wax moth and other undesirables might hang out. So if you have drawn comb that has nothing in it and it's in one of those upper places, you may want to pull that. Take that drawn comb, you know, secure it and store it however you typically do that. And, you know, nothing wrong with that. You can always pull the entire deep, extract the honey for yourself on those two mediums. Nothing wrong with that. Throw them into the freezer, put them aside. You may have that colony or another one runs into a bind. They're running a little bit light through the dearth. That gives you a backup that you can feed to them. Nothing wrong with that either. I think somebody had commented like, oh yeah, this one guy mentioned he just takes the surplus ones and just puts them in the bee yard and lets them kind of rob it clean or whatever. I don't like that at all. Like I'm going to have it before I just give it away. I mean, that's just like going out and buying like a $30 jar of some great organic honey and just pouring it on the ground. But if I'm taking it off for whatever reason, it's not staying on the hive. It's going in the freezer. It's getting extracted. Like something's happening, but I'm not going to give it to the bees randomly in the yard unless there's a bee that needs it. Happy to help them out. But outside of that, like I said, I just, there's no need to really break anything down unless there's some kind of a problem. Now, when it gets to the end of the year, so, you know, let's say, for example, that the bees in that same configuration, two deeps and a medium, over the course of that summer, they've used a lot of those resources and maybe it's only one entire deep worth of stuff. Like maybe they used an entire deep worth of honey. The medium only has those two frames and there's nothing left of that. You may go ahead and consolidate down to a single deep at that point in time and then let them build out over the fall. And you know, maybe you go ahead and leave the honey super on and see how much they can build up, you know, during that time. That's where it can get a little bit tricky, right? You go into the cooler time of year with a big gap and a big space like that. That can become a challenge because now you've got another area that the climate has to be controlled, right? You have this space that needs to be heated and it's a lot more difficult for the bees to do that. It makes it much more difficult for them to maintain a good, comfortable, sustainable wintertime temperature. So that's where it becomes really important to break down. But during the year, like I said, you shouldn't have a big need to do that unless they've gone through a lot of resources during the dearth. So let's see. Somebody said after that question was asked, they said, I've wondered about that too. If you have a partially filled super when the drift starts, can you just leave that on in lieu of a feeder? Absolutely. Yes, that could be your feeder. Absolutely. In one book I have, the author just sets his uncapped frames out in the bee yard for them to clean up. But that's more for the end of the season. Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that either. Like, it's the end of the year, and you've got things that just have some odds and ends on that the bees can probably use, but that you're not going to use as you're getting ready to store them away. Sure, why not? And then somebody says, I wonder if you can just leave them on, and if they don't use it, they'll just move it down to where they want. Yeah, they can do that too. They can move it around from place to place as they see fit if they don't like where it is currently stored. Absolutely. And let's see. So basically all the honey they are making will be eaten by fall, and I'll be down to just two medium boxes. I understand the growing process, but I'm a little hazy after the nectar flow stops. So after the nectar flow stops, it can get kind of funky. And what I mean by that, I'm not talking like the cool 70s get down funky disco kind of thing. I mean like it can get strange. And what I mean specifically is one of the most common things that happens pretty much every year. This is about the time of year where people start reaching out and talking to me about this. As the colony recognizes that the nectar flow is beginning to taper and the resources are diminishing and there's just not as much available, the colony is like, all right, not as much coming in. We're not making any more mouths to feed. That's it. Now, the queen's going to keep laying eggs because she's just a queen, you know, she's a queen machine. She just cranks out eggs. That's what she does for a living. But the colony won't raise those bees. They won't raise brood. So they'll just eat them, discard them. That's it. It's gone. They will not raise brood. So a lot of people will open up their hive in like June 15, 20, wherever, July 4th, whatever time of year you're doing an inspection in your area where there is a dearth, and they don't see eggs. They don't see anything, and they don't see cap brood, and they start to really, really freak out. I know I did it. Like, that's what I did early on. I'm like, oh my God, my queen's gone. It's all over, you know, or even worse, when I didn't understand the whole dynamics of all of this, I was like making splits like the first week of June, you know, late May, first week of June, I'm making splits and they're like not raising a queen or they're not doing anything. I'm like, well, this is terrible. I've only got three frames or four frames in this whole colony. They're not doing anything. Why aren't they doing anything? What's going on? If there's no food, there is no brood. Simple as that. So that's, again, one of the most common things where people will look around through the hive doing an inspection, can't find their queen, and they're like, okay, what's going on? So that's part one. So really, really look in detail, every single frame, get a friend to help you, use a shaker box, whatever you have to do, be 100% certain before you try to introduce another queen. And then the other thing that's going to be weird too is you've gotten used to having a big population and it's going to start to dwindle. It's going to get smaller. And you've gotten used to seeing like so much cool productivity and bees coming in all the time and going in and out. And it's just so, it's just exciting. It's exhilarating. And then like there's nothing going on. Like you got bees like sitting out on the front porch, like looking at you like, what do you want? You know, and you're like, I want you to go to work. And they're like, there's no work. There's no jobs. Like they can't. They got nothing. So they're literally just hanging out on the front porch and they're walking around and just, you know, waiting for a nectar flow or waiting for somebody to find a feeder somewhere and come back and tell everybody, hey, there's a feeder over here, and do a little waggle dance and get them going. So, yeah, so this is a time when the nectar flow stops. You just got to be mindful that things are going to be a little bit different and just pay attention to those differences, make notes, and it'll be easier to deal with again when you look at year two and three.
When I was little, my grandmother had bird feeders and a bird bath in her backyard. Some of my favorite memories growing up were listening to her tell me everything she knew about the feathered friends that visited her yard daily. How amazing would it have been for us to be able to capture images and videos of that experience and to be able to share them with others? Well, if you're ready to take your backyard bird watching to the next level, FeatherSnap makes Wi-Fi-enabled smart bird feeders that blend the best of technology and nature. Get a high-def glimpse of your feathered friends with a top-of-the-line camera so every visitor can be seen with clarity and detail. A unique dual-feeder bin helps attract more species, and built-in solar panels keep your camera's battery going strong. FeatherSnap's mobile app creates a truly immersive experience, allowing you to collect and organize your favorite pics and videos and earn badges along the way. Best of all, FeatherSnap offers expert-trained AI identification of more than 275 North American species thanks to their in-house ornithologist. Check them out today at feathersnapcam.com. That's feathersnapcam.com. beekeeping.com.
As most of you know, I'm a big fan of the outdoors, and most of my time is dedicated to beekeeping and gardening related discussions. But you probably did not know that one of my responsibilities as a kid was caring for our houseplants. Yes, part of my $5 a week allowance went towards making sure all of the houseplants were healthy and happy. We used to have shamrocks, Christmas cactus, philodendron, and more. Which leads us to today's podcast sponsor, and a special thanks to Palm Street. Palm Street is the best live shopping app for the plant lover community. You can buy and sell rare plants, crystals, ceramics, and other unique goods. Connect with trusted plant sellers and nurseries that sell nationwide. Shop 24/7 and with live human customer support. What I love most about Palm Street is joining a live stream where sellers walk through all the details and characteristics of the plants they're offering. You can get live answers to your questions and see what questions others have asked as well. It's such a great way to engage for buyers and sellers. And as a special offer, new users will receive $5 app credit, 10% off their first order, and up to $6 off shipping for 3 orders. Palm Street, available on Google Play or the App Store.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, the next question. If I'm being told that I'm buying Italian bees, how do I know that's what I'm getting? And then someone said, I recently asked a similar question here with a pick and no one knew the species. Is it that hard to tell the difference? Am I that ignorant to think species are discernible to the layman? So I think where you have the difference between like species versus race. So again, I'm not a biologist, entomologist, scientist kind of guy, but I'm pretty sure that when you talk about like Saskatraz, Carniolan, Italians, Buckfast, whatever, all of those are like the species of the European honeybee, but those are individual races, I think is how that is technically done. And if you think about like the human race, like with people are, we're all mutts of some sort, you know, we all come out of Europe and Asia and Africa and different places. And we have all these different genetics that are kind of, you know, embedded deep down inside of us. The bees are kind of the same way. And again, I'm just kind of like taking a little bit of a shot in the dark here. I'm not an expert with this, but if you think about it, let's say that I have purebred Italian bees that I'm raising in my bee yard. And the guy next door has a bunch of Russian, he's got Russian bees and Carniolans. And then my virgin queens are going out and they're mating with his drones. Well, now they're Russian-Italian and they're Italian-Carniolan. And so it's like, it doesn't take long. You know, you're always, you know, one virgin queen away from losing any kind of genetics. That's where I used to pick on the people who do the VSH queens. Like, you're going to give me a VSH queen for $400 and her daughter queens are going to mate with a bunch of drones that have no VSH benefits to them at all. And it's a toss of a coin, like a 50-50 shot on every one of these drones as to whether or not you're going to have that, you know, varroa sensitivity. So I don't know. I think a lot of these places are just looking at the picture. I'm like, those Italian queens tend to have that really big, bright, orangey kind of look to them. But I've seen other queens that are supposed to be Italians and they're as black as they can be. They're really, really dark. So I don't have a good answer on that one because, you know, again, right, let's say I have an Italian queen. That Italian queen that I'm queen grafting, that I'm making those queen cells from, she mated with 20 or 25 different drones. So if those drones were anything else, any of those eggs I graft, I could graft and make 30 grafts and put them in there to my cell builder and have queens that come out, you know, that are 5 different colors across all of them. So I don't have an answer for you on that one. I apologize. How often do you see more than one queen cohabitating, even if it's for a brief period of time, in a hive? I know that I have had more than one queen in a hive before. I know that I have had queens kill each other before. Like, I know that some people, when it's time to combine hives at the end of the year, they just combine the hives and may the best queen win. I don't really like that idea, primarily because I just don't want to have like basically having two colonies simultaneously balling the other's queens and then nobody has anything. So I prefer to kind of handle it that way. But I'll give you a couple of examples of when I have seen queens cohabitating. Example one, you have a regular colony. They're getting ready to swarm. All of a sudden, really bad weather comes in, and they need to swarm. They need to leave. Well, virgin queens are mated. Well, these are the daughter queens. So you have mother queen and daughter queens that are emerging. So let's say you have the first virgin daughter queen is born. She runs around. She starts stinging the other virgin queens inside the queen cells. Let's say that she gets that all worked out. And now you just have her and the mother queen. They will actually cohabitate with each other for a decent amount of time. I haven't studied it, so I can't say exactly how long they will go. But they're fine together, in my experience, for those few days while they're waiting until everything gets settled and the weather gets better, and then they swarm. The other scenario where I've seen them cohabitate is the one where you have the divided deep setup. A lot of people are calling them resource colonies. I think of nucleus colonies as resource colonies, but you have a deep divided in half, four frames on each side, four frame nucle on top of that on each side, four frame nucle on top of that on each side. Then you put in a queen excluder, and then you put honey supers. In that scenario, queen number one will always stay on the left side. Queen number two will always stay on the right side. All of the workers can go up, over, around, and go anywhere they want to go. And nobody's killing anybody's queens. No queens are killing each other because the queens are physically isolated by the queen excluder. But no other bees are going around killing other queens. Those are kind of the two scenarios where I've seen them cohabitate together. I would love to have colonies where I could have three queens in there at the same time, just cranking out brood. But unfortunately, that's not really realistic. So that's all I've got for you on that one. You know, sometimes they will, for whatever reason, get along. I just haven't seen it a lot in my experience, but I have heard people talk about it. Should I still do inspections if my virgin queen is on a mating flight? I would say that you want to stay on your regular scheduled inspection time. Let's just say that, you know, you reach in, you do an inspection, you're pulling frames out, and you see, queen has hatched, and the queen, you know, there's a hole right in the bottom of the queen cell, she's hatched. Other cells are either missing or they've got a hole in the side of them, and you know, you're like, okay, so she must be, you're looking all through the hive, everything, you find no queen. She's definitely on her mating flight. I want to see her hopefully like in a week. So if I know at that point in time, she's already gone. So let's say it's a Saturday, I'm doing that inspection. She's already gone. So I'm assuming she left at, you know, at the latest, she left maybe Friday. I'm going to come back and re-inspect again Saturday or Sunday the following week. That gives her 8 or 9 days. And I'm hoping to see some eggs. I may not. The mating flight may have taken longer than it should have. She may have come back, isn't quite ready to lay yet. But I want to always be inspecting on a regular schedule because it's not just about the queen. It's the general health of the colony. You're looking for foul brood, chalk brood, any kind of brood-related illnesses, small hive beetle, wax moth, any kind of robbing, any behavior, any moisture, anything that's going on that shouldn't be going on, you still always want to check for those types of things. I say just stay on your regular schedule, keep doing your inspections. And like I said, once you get through the flow, and you're into more of like a balanced time of year, depending on, you know, where you are and what your nectar flow looks like, you know, you can push those inspections back to 2 weeks. I definitely don't recommend more than that. Yes, you can get away with it, but, you know, it just doesn't take long. If you get a little wax moth in there, right, and it gets in there 2 days after you did an inspection, you don't show up again for 3 weeks, yeah, that colony is probably gone. Same thing with the small hive beetle. You know, they can show up and you're like, oh, look at the cute little beetle. He's just hanging out. What a nice little fellow. And you come back 3 weeks later and there's like 400 of them, right? Like, you got to be aggressive with that. You got to change those high beetle traps out. You know, you just got some regular maintenance to do. And plus, it never hurts to keep those frames moving so they don't get too hard to maneuver. If you leave frames in place for too long, they will continue to propolize them and really get them stuck together, and then it becomes a pain in the butt to get them out. Then you're stressed out because you're trying to remove these really, really heavily stuck frames. It just gets to be painful. So I want to provide a large water source for my bees, such as a small pond style. Anyone have any suggestions? So this is one that we've had several times, and I've told this. I'll tell you two stories that are my favorites on this. One of them is when I moved into this house, my neighbor came over and he was like, hey, look, I know you got honeybees. I don't have a problem with the bees at all. I love them. They're great. But, you know, you're losing a lot of them in my pool. They're drowning in my pool. And I was like, yeah, I'm really sorry about that. You know, for whatever reason, they tend to do that. And You know, I told him, you know, you're going to lose about 200, 250 bees a day just through, you know, attrition, through spiders, whatever other things are in the environment that are trying to eat them or kill them, and just old age. And I said, so it's just kind of part of the process, but I hope they don't sting you or that they're not problematic for you. And he's like, no, it's no problem. So like the next day he comes over and he's got an old bucket from his pool chlorine tabs and he's washed it out. He's got it all clean and he's got it full of water. And he took a piece of wood, he cut it to size to fit inside of it and then drilled a whole bunch of holes in it. And he's like, hey, I made this water feeder thing with these holes and this wood floats in here so they can walk on the wood and they can drink water. And it was a really, really kind gesture. It was a really, really nice thing for this gentleman to do. And I told him, I said, hey, I really, really appreciate your effort on this. It was really nice of you. I said, but just so you know, like honeybees are really weird about that. Like they don't just drink the cool, nice, yummy, clean water that like normal things would do. And he was like, okay. I said, but I'll put it out. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I put it out. I think over the course of the next 3 weeks, I think I saw bees on it, you know, four or five times. You'd see a couple of them that were on it. But the problem is you now create a mosquito breeding ground. So like I had to like empty it every day and put fresh water in. But again, it was a really kind gesture, which I do appreciate. But the bees had no interest in it whatsoever. But down at the apiary, there is a puddle that's about 50 feet away from where most of the colonies are. And there is this puddle, it's about 4 feet in diameter, probably. The bees are always all, it's a muddy, gross puddle. I've posted pictures of it in the Discord room and stuff. It's the muddiest, like just a gross puddle. And they're all over it drinking that funky water. So like, I would not go to any great length to try to make a watering, you know, like a watering hole for them or whatever. If you wanted to make something already that was part of your plans, you know, just create a little section off to the side where you put a, you know, a container with a bunch of dirt and grimy, gross stuff in it. And they'll probably go just drink out of that. It's funny. We were joking about it in the Discord room, but that's it. I mean, you can take a bunch of dirt, put it into something that has water in it, shake it up and make it look kind of gross. They'll be interested in it. Alrighty. The question came up about plastic foundation and the quote pre-wax that comes with it. And I think that somebody had even commented something like, oh, I think wherever this came from, they were using some cheap wax and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't good quality or whatever. The reality is I've bought some of the good stuff and it's a really, really light coating of wax on those pre-waxed plastic foundation pieces. And if you take them out of the box, like the day or the week you get them, put them into a hive, you're probably going to have a decent chance of getting some acceptance. But that's it. After a couple of months, they're blown. They won't work. They won't do anything for you. So here are a couple of quick steps for addressing that and getting them to accept that plastic foundation. Number one is spray sugar syrup. This is one that a lot of people use. I have done this myself. I really haven't had a lot of luck with this. You basically just take the frame, spray it all over front and back with just a traditional regular sprayer that you buy from the local hardware store or whatever. Mix up a little bit of sugar syrup. You probably want to make it a little bit lighter than you normally do so that it doesn't get too thick to spray. And you definitely want to rinse out the sprayer thoroughly when you're done doing that, or it will completely gum up on the inside and it'll be a one-use spray bottle for you. But I've used this before and it just doesn't work that well. Sometimes it helps a little bit. It definitely will bring them and draw them to the frame. But if they don't need to draw wax right now, they're not going to draw wax. They're not going to just start drawing comb, I should say, not wax. They're not going to start drawing comb if they don't need to draw comb. But hey, they're always going to enjoy a sugary snack, so there is that. The next approach would be to melt wax. We've talked about this, right? Taking some, you know, wax foundation that you already have or taking some honeycomb you have, however you want to do it, and go ahead and melt that down. And you can use a little roller or a paintbrush. I always start at the top where the plastic foundation meets your wooden frame on the top, or if it's all plastic, just at the top where the top plastic meets the foundation kind of plastic. Start at the top. Make sure you get the top on both sides done well. If you at least have that done really well, it gives them sort of a starter strip. But if you have enough wax, go ahead and wax the entire thing, and that's going to be great. If you don't have anything that you can melt and roll on, kind of in a pinch, what I've done is I've taken just a hunk of burr comb or a hunk of old wax and just kind of rolled into a ball and just rub that on. Like if, you know, if you've ever been on like a, if you were a kid and you had one of those old sleds with the rails on them and the runners, you know, you just like you're waxing that, or if you're waxing a surfboard, same kind of thing, right? Just grab the wax, run over it both sides, and you're done. Oh, and if you see them, one thing that happens quite a bit I've seen with plastic foundation and some of these different types of different manufacturers, but the bees will be drawing up comb, and they will draw a nice, beautiful, pretty comb. But instead of drawing it off of the foundation, they will hang it from the foundation. Get on that early. Don't let them do that, because then you end up with them laying on the front of the foundation, the back of the foundation. You can have the queen or other bees on the back. You're pushing frames in and out. Now they're larger than they should be. The queen could be in the back, and you could squish it in between a couple things when you're reinserting the frame and you crush your queen. As soon as you see that foundation being drawn over, just press it flat. Just go across the whole thing and press it flat. You don't have to like squish it really crazy. Like just get it to where there's nothing around the edges that allows them to walk under it, and get it just flush to the plastic comb that's underneath, and just flatten it out. Once the actual comb itself is there, they can draw it back up and, you know, move it into whatever shape that they want to do. That's the more labor intense part of it, is for them to actually generate the wax itself. Once it's generating, it's there, they can draw it up and redraw it the way they want. But don't let them draw that kind of wonky comb like that. Next on the list, we have keeping a smoker lit. The key that I found to a smoker, and there's lots of different ways and things that are advertised and sold that you can use to light the smoker, keep the smoker going or whatever. I use a little propane torch to light it, and I do it just like I do a campfire. I do like pine needles and a little bit of leaves, and if you have some straw is fine. Little sticks, pine cones, like whatever is laying around. I just get a mix of things. Some of it's really small and fine. Some of it's a little bit larger. And again, going back to the campfire analogy, you want some stuff that's going to burn really, really quick and hot to get going. You want some stuff that then catches fire and is going to burn for a long time. So that's the real trick, is getting a good mix of things in there and just kind of packing it in. And there's also commercially available stuff. I think I posted in the Discord room a couple days ago where it's basically like a half pound bag of stuff that looks like insulation, like blown in insulation. Please don't actually use blown in insulation. I'm sure it's got fiberglass and other crap in it that you don't want getting around your bees, but it looks like insulation. Take that, push that down into the smoker as well. And once you have all those things really burning well, again, it's the varying sizes. I have some twigs and sticks and things that are about the size of my pinky, and those are going to burn and smoke for a lot longer. So give that a shot, give that a try, see how that works. So I see another question here at the end. How often do you treat with oxalic acid? I think I just covered that a bit earlier, so we're going to drop that off. And the last question that I have here for the day, it's not a question, it's actually a clarifying statement. I've made the statement on more than one occasion, particularly I heard it today when I was reviewing the winterization episode. When I say wet bees are dead bees, I don't mean that a honeybee flying around in the rain is not going to survive if she gets wet, right? I don't mean that. The context with which I made the statement is around bees getting wet in wintertime when they are inside the hive overwintering, and the heat from the cluster combined with the cool air from the outside causes condensation to form on the sides and the roof, primarily like the roof of the hive, and it will form drops, and those drops will then drip onto the bees. It gets them wet and they will die. So when I say wet bees are dead bees, I am strictly and specifically referring to in an overwintering condition when it's really cold out. And again, that's primarily a lack of ventilation. You do want a lot, you know, a decent amount of cold air to still come in to offset that. Whole different discussion. But yeah, wet bees are dead bees is not relating to anything during a regular flow or normal day-to-day life. Well, everybody, it looks like we made it through this episode as well. I can't believe the amount of time we took here. I really thought I was going to get all this into one episode, but these questions have been building up for a while, and I'm glad we got to them. As always, feel free to join the Discord room. If you go to beekeepingfornewbies.com, that's NEWBEES.com. There's a link there at the top of the Discord page. Feel free to join us, come in there, ask questions, participate. If you're a beekeeper and you've got a lot to share, by all means, we want to hear what you have to say as well. There's tons of great folks in there chit-chatting all the time. And, you know, if you have questions for me, again, it's Jeff at beekeepingfornewbies.com. And what else do we have? Oh, hey, hit us up on YouTube. Check us out on youtube.com/@beekeepingfornewbies. I think that's about all I got, folks. So I'm going to let you go. Be kind to one another. And I love you. There's nothing you can do about that. Take care.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.